There is this thing.
Do you realize
what is there is this thing?
Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's community news program, Off the Hour. Today is Friday, July 22nd. My name is Alice Wu, and I will be your host today. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Ginyangahaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Cinema Politica is thrilled to announce the theatrical release of Dear Jackie, a feature documentary by Henri Pardo. The film opens on June 17 in 4 theaters in Montreal: Cinéma Public, Cinéma du Musée, Cinémathèque Québécoise, and Cinéma Moderne, with the director and special guests in attendance at select screenings. Dear Jackie poetically tells the story of one of the oldest black communities in Canada, Montreal's Little Burgundy, by way of a cinematic letter to Jackie Robinson, the first black man to break the color barrier in professional baseball. It also masterfully connects history to the present by challenging the myth of a post-racial society. This release is co-presented by Desta Black Youth Network, Tyndale St. George's Community Center, Canteen Bergs, and Makisia Solo. For more information and tickets, visit cinemapolitica.org. We hope to see you there. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
First, news. This week, Montreal is experiencing its first heat wave of the summer, which is putting the city's unhoused population at risk. A spokesperson for Urgence Santé said that last weekend, the emergency services saw a surge in calls about the heat wave. On Sunday, 9 people in the city were treated for heat stroke symptoms. And the Quebec government has approved the Moderna vaccine called Spikevax for children between 6 months and 5 years old. Parents can get appointments through the province's Clic Santé health portal. Quebec recommends 2 doses and waiting at least 8 weeks between doses. Some immunocompromised children may get a 3rd dose. And Pope Francis is making a week-long visit to Canada, and he will be in Quebec City from July 27th to July 29th. The Roman Catholic Church says the goal of the visit is to promote healing among the First Nations, Métis, and Inuit communities whose children endured abuse in residential schools. And this week, the Quebec Transport Ministry shared that the Legault government's plans to extend Highway 25 would cut through a, quote, refuge forest, end quote, for vulnerable species. This would result in the removal of hundreds of trees and a major loss in biodiversity. Highway 25 ends near the town Saint-Esprit, 65 kilometers northwest of Montreal. Welcome back to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. The time is just after 5. My name is Alice Wu. Up first on this episode of Off the Hour, we'll be listening to a brief excerpt from an interview between Howard Stretch Carr and Gemma Rayburn Baines. Stretch is the host of West Indian Rhythms on the station. They'll discuss the case of racial profiling that took place last month outside Gemma's business, Green's Restaurant in Lachine.
And even on the 24th, they came. They didn't give any tickets for noise because the music was not that loud. Mm-hmm. So that was just an excuse.
Sure, they didn't give an excuse.
No arrests, no incidents, no reports. They just all got back in their car after half an hour. and drove off.
Yeah. They didn't find
and they thought it was
for.
The end.
Yep.
But it was not. It was just the beginning.
Well,
it was not the end.
Continue following it up, and you have the backing of your community here. So don't be shy. They need to know us again. If that, I'm using the term again because we've been down this road before.
Oh yeah.
To hear more from Stretch, tune into West Indian Rhythms, which broadcasts on CKUT 90.3 FM on Saturdays from 4 to 7 p.m. Now for the second segment of the hour, we'll stick with the theme of anti-Black racism and we'll tune into the It's Going Down podcast. This episode explores the ideas of the late Noel Ignatieff, a radical author and organizer. Keep listening to hear about how race and class struggles intersect in the U.S. and beyond. We'll be back at the top of the hour with some news you can use.
It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
My name is John Garvey. I first met Noel Ignatieff, then Ignatin, in 1976. I'd already been a little bit familiar with some of his writings. Worked, closely with him when he was in Sojourner Truth Organization and others, although I was never a member of the group. When Noel and I continued to work together, mostly informally and somewhat episodically, for the 1980s, and then in the early 1990s, we together founded and co-edited the Race Traitor Journal. We did that for 12 years. That we felt that had kind of basically lived out its political trajectory. It was time to stop it. Around 2015, a couple of loyal subscribers and writers to Race Traitor urged us to start it up again, and we declined to do that. And felt that the time was different, and instead suggested, more Noel than I, that we do something related to Race Traitor, but different. And that's what led to the Hardcrackers publication, which I guess the first issue came out at the end of 2016. And Noel was really, in many ways, the profound guiding spirit of that project. So he and I worked together more or less continuously for 40-odd years.
My name is Geert Dant. I'm a professor of economics at John Jay College, the City University of New York. I met Noel through in the late 1990s in Arizona through my involvement with the anti-globalization movement and particularly through Joel Olson. Later on, I was close to Noel for 20 years. And in various different ways. One way was through an organization we were part. He was not a member of, but he was close to, called Bring the Ruckus. And also, I co-taught with him at Mass College of Arts. I was an adjunct professor there, and that was a lot of fun. And also more recently at John Jay College in the fall of 2018, we taught a course together with the idea thinking about dual power.
Hi, my name is Jana Kurthi. I'm so excited to be on this show. I'm a big fan, listen to you guys all the time. So really excited to talk about this book and Noel today. Quickly, I'm one of the editors of Hardcrackers, Chronicles of Everyday Life, which, as both John and Geert are also editors of. Also, one of the editors for this new notebook, Treason to Whiteness is Loyalty to Humanity, which has collected his political writings over the span of over 50 years. I first came to know Noel mostly through his writing, and as a college student who was kind of fed up with a lot of the liberalism and the way in which white privilege was being talked about in academia and activist spaces mostly. And then one day I came across a Race Traitor journal lying in one of the student offices, and I picked it up, and man, never been the same again. So it kind of did change how I understood whiteness, how I understood, you know, my own identity as an Albanian growing up in the Bronx, one of the last ethnic whites in New York City. So, and then years later, during Occupy, I got a chance to meet Noel and, you know, got a chance to talk with him, and was really, you know, really surprised to see how, like, energetic and how much he really did believe that, you know, there was so much capacity in the United States at any moment for, you know, for working class people to come together and change things. And then in 2017, I joined the Heartcrackers editorial board, and we're kind of, you know, continuing important work, unfortunately, without Noel. But, you know, we continue on, and yeah, we're so excited to share some of that, those political writings with you all today.
Noel is such an interesting character. You know, before he passed, we were lucky enough to have him on the show and interview him, but it was awesome to pick his brain, and he's just such a fascinating character because in many regards he is still a boogeyman on the far right, as somebody that talks about race and whiteness. And it's interesting because, you know, his real views have just been so skewed by his enemies. And I'm excited again that we can dive into a lot of this stuff. But some of y'all have mentioned the project Heartcrackers, so let's just pause real quick and talk about that. What is Heartcrackers, and how did it come about?
So as I mentioned in the opening, okay, that Heartcrackers was the result of an unsuccessful effort by some to persuade Noel and me to relaunch Race Traitor. And instead, we reached out to a number of other friends, political friends, personal friends, half a dozen or so, to suggest the possibility of doing something different that, as John has mentioned, was focused on the events and the activities and the daydreams and the ideas of everyday life as an organizing principle. From the very beginning, Heartcrackers was going to walk on two legs. It was going to have a print journal, and it was simultaneously was going to have a web page. I think that kind of at the beginning, the emphasis was on the print journal, and the somewhat lesser emphasis on the web page. And we sometimes didn't quite have it all figured out about what should be where. But anyway, we did eventually make some progress. But what happened then, Noel died at the end of 2019, in November of 2019, shortly thereafter, okay, the pandemic broke, and then more or less on the heels of the pandemic, the George Floyd uprising began. And the remaining editorial group in the beginning of 2020, around the time we had organized a memorial for Noel, we made a decision that we would continue to do the project and see what came of it. And we've been successful at doing that now for, you know, 2.5 years. I mentioned the development of both the pandemic and the uprising. Those were very important for the development of the project because we effectively suspended publication of the print journal for a bunch of reasons and focused all of our attention on the web, except that we had kind of an abundance of material to work with, both things that the editors wrote themselves, along with probably hundreds of other contributors in the last 2.5 years. And my guess is that if you kind of counted the post that we did on the uprising, maybe 50, the post we did on the epidemic, maybe 50, and it really it transformed, I think, the momentum. I guess the webpage at the beginning had been somewhat a sleepy afterthought, and it became instead the vibrant front and center of the project.
I was just going to add something that I really appreciate about the Heartcrackers as a project and why I joined. And I joined in 2017, which was, you know, this was like on the heels of the Bernie phenomenon, where every major stripe of leftists somehow joined the social democratic bandwagon. And I think Heartcrackers for me signaled a group of people that were obviously very interested in politics and being involved when they could in kind of understanding the terrain, but were not necessarily outwardly political, that they were going to lecture people and tell them what to think about the situation. Or, you know, in the case of after 2016, you know, berate Trump voters for who they voted or for being racist or sexist or what have you, right? So I appreciated that instead of, you know, doing kind of, you know, that they would try to understand where people and try to meet people where they were at, right? And trying to understand the current terrain through interviews, through talking to everyday people, through really trying to understand the contradictions that are shaping the current terrain that we're all living through. And man, there's so many damn contradictions, right? And I think in this way, our kind of original mission that American society is a time bomb, right? Where it's this impending explosion waiting to happen. And we're trying to understand it all, right? And all of the ways in, you know, these daily events shape lives, shape decisions, shape how people see the world. I really, really appreciated that. And I think we've tried to stay faithful to that through the work that we've done in the past, you know, especially after Noel unfortunately passed away as well. The second thing I'll say is what I appreciate about working with folks in Heartcrackers, and there's currently nine of us on the editorial board, including Jared Shanahan, who is one of the editors of the book as well. It really also looks at the American terrain, right? And I say American terrain because something that I hope we'll get to in this podcast is that something that Noel really contributed to a lot in terms of political thinking about revolution and the possibility of revolution was that instead of looking towards constantly European models, you know, the Paris Commune or the Bolshevik, I mean, there's people arguing about like 1917 on Twitter, on Facebook all the time, right? And it's not to say that shouldn't be taken seriously, but Noel took very seriously the Civil War as a very important revolutionary moment, Reconstruction, right? And he argued that that was more in line of how things would unfold in the United States, right? So I think that kind of attentiveness to the material conditions in America, and of course, through a global perspective, but really focusing on what are those specificities that may be a little bit different, right? Like how race and whiteness function a little differently in the United States than elsewhere, I think is really important. And that's something that I also kind of really appreciate about Heartcrackers and, you know, some of the work we've been doing.
Why is it important that a book on Noel Ignatieff comes out now?
I think it's really excited to have this book out, Treason to Whiteness and Loyalty to Humanity, because of what it can bring to a current generation of activists trying to deal with new crises that will constantly emerge. And to be able to, Noel was a really clear writer that would challenge us, and I think will continue to challenge us through these readings and be helpful in guiding us you know, through the current crises. So for example, originally my first title suggestion was an American agitator and a Noel Ignatieff reader or something like that. And it was about Noel was really focused, as Jana just said, about the U.S. context. He would be very mad at people or say, oh, American education sucks, when people didn't know stuff about, say, the French Revolution. But he wasn't really, he was really focused on the abolitionists, which was some of his favorite groups in history, and also like the Wobblies and the IWW, which he was always talking about as an example to use. And I think it's like through these readings, we can think about current crises through a different lens. And so he brought out a thinking about strategy, which is sometimes we forget. It's like we have to be, when we try to fight for a new world, we have to be strategic to how we do these things. He was always an uncompromising revolutionary. And what I mean by that, he thought it was like, in a book we write about, have an essay there and write about dual power. And so, for example, for the way Noel talked about dual power is that, in a sense, you can always, there's always two options in any crisis situation. And one is to resist the state, or one is to side with the state. And the goal of revolutionaries is to always resist the state and official society and use this kind of dual power that exists in any crisis moment and develop it into a revolutionary one. And I think that's really helpful to think about crises that emerge. And I think it's also, and also he's most famous for his writings about race. And you'll see throughout the book, from the 1960s to 2019, race was an important component of his writings and his analysis of U.S. history and his analysis of our strategy for revolution. And one of his earliest writings in the book is a piece from The White Blind Spot, written in 1966. And it symbolizes, I just want to read a quick quote from this, because it symbolizes what I'm talking about here. So it says, "Of all the struggles in which a popular victory would fatally weaken U.S. capitalism, the fight against white supremacy is the one with the greatest chance of success." And so this is, it's a strategic choice to focus on fighting white supremacy. And the goal is not to diversify, you know, anything, but the goal is to abolish whiteness in order to abolish capitalism.
I think for a new generation of abolitionists, folks who are very disenchanted with both the two-party system and kind of sometimes the limits of social democracy, I think Noel is a really important person. And I think more than ever, actually, we need a lot more conversations across generations of lessons that we have learned historically, what that means for the present. And I can't think of a better revolutionary than Noel Ignatieff, in the sense that he consistently, and, you know, we're going to come back to this over and over again, but, you know, he consistently wrote about struggles as he lived through them, right? So for over five decades, he, you know, he engaged with those struggles. And the book in many ways speaks to that, right? And we divide it into four parts, you know, going by kind of the main contributions that he made. And we began the introduction, and I think this is kind of really important. Noel, in an interview before he passed away a year prior, you know, talked about his political activism, right? He said he sums it up in three things, which is labor in the white skin cannot be free, where in the black it is branded. For revolutionaries, dual power is the peace strategy, and the emancipation of the working class is the task of the workers themselves. And I would say, man, these three propositions have certainly lived five decades and continue to be really relevant. I think as new, we see new waves of struggle, right? Whether that is, you know, rank and file workers in Amazon trying to galvanize, right, and get together and win some collective power. Whether that is the thousands upon thousands of young people that took to the streets for the George Floyd rebellion. You know, I think as more and more young people are being politicized, I think this book and some of the lessons it offers will be really important. And, you know, I'm sure we'll flesh some of those lessons out.
So I'd like to add something a little bit different, and that has to do with suggesting to the listeners that the essays in this book are, of course, very, very important, but it kind of, the fuller measure of Noel's contributions over all those years can be taken by reading some other things as well. Perhaps he is most well-known in academic circles for the book he wrote titled How the Irish Became White. He also wrote a memoir of his time spent in the U.S. Steel Gary Works as a steel worker. He edited two collections of writings, one of Wendell Phillips, Lesson of the Hour, and the other C.L.R. James, A New Notion. And in addition, we can have published a special issue of Hardcrackers devoted to Noel in, I guess, the early part of 2021. And I think that kind of it would be very valuable for people to kind of to look at all of those texts to try to develop a fuller appreciation of what it was that Noel was thinking, what he was trying to do. I think that Geert and Jana and Jared did a spectacular job of picking choices, making choices from the broad array of other writings that Noel had done in, you know, kind of going back to his time before Sojourner Truth, in Sojourner Truth, you know, in Race Traitor and whatever, okay? But there's a lot more still beyond the book, and I would urge people to investigate that. I should mention is that the memoir of his life in the steel mill is titled Acceptable Men, and that's been published by Charles Kirk Publishers.
Fantastic. Well, you brought up one of his books, and we're going to talk about that right now, and he's indeed very well known for it. The book, again, is How the Irish Became White. I'm just curious if you can talk about this book in particular and its impact and how it has had this lasting effect on people trying to understand whiteness through the prism of looking at the Irish coming to the United States.
I was in pretty constant contact with Noel during the years that he was writing the dissertation and then the book. And he was, as Geert mentioned earlier, he was a very fine writer. He was also... He worked very, very hard at his writing to make it come out fine. And his starting point, the argument was, is that in the case of the Irish and of others, is that whiteness is not a natural biological characteristic. In fact, race is not a natural biological fact of any kind. If it's not natural, then it's social and historical. But the question is, well, actually, how does something become social and historical? What is the process of its development? And that's what he tried to chronicle in the book on the Irish, of how they arrived as the most desperate, miserable people on the planet, perhaps other than the black slaves in America. And, you know, kind of for a while, it was imagined that they were more or less interchangeable with the black slaves and were held in deep contempt by all. But over time, they basically kind of managed, okay, to kind of to make it, so to speak, except for Noel, okay, they hardly made it. They betrayed their souls and their futures by becoming white. And then he wants, later on, as we worked in Race Traitor, the argument of the becoming of white is a very, very central feature in American history, and one that continues to this day, that there are many people whose ancestors today, from today, back in the 19th century, Italians, Greeks, Arabs, whatever, who were not considered white, who in roughly comparable ways as to the Irish became white. And then once having become white, they became most of the time very determined to remain white and to preserve their whiteness because of the advantages that it conferred. And the last argument is, the piece of the argument is, if something is historical, if something has come to be, then something can be undone, something can be reversed, something can be abolished. And one of the examples I would suggest of Noel's fine distinctions is it used to drive him crazy back in the days of the early 1990s and the later 1990s when people talked about the need to deconstruct racism or deconstruct whiteness, and he would be enraged, okay? We're not going to deconstruct anything. What we're going to do is we're going to abolish it. We're going to create the possibility for humanity, and thus the slogan of Treason to Whiteness is Loyalty to Humanity. And those were, you know, kind of Noel, much that Noel had written in the years prior to his return to graduate school in the mid-80s was anticipating some of the directions in which you would then go over the course of the next year, but they were not yet fully articulated. He and I co-authored an essay in 1986-87 where I would say that there's the embryonic notions of what the argument would eventually be about whiteness and the abolition of the white race and eventually the abolition of all races as a category of any value. So that was a key moment in his own intellectual development. And the book, you know, kind of continues to, I think, enthrall people to this day. And I should mention one thing about it is that there are a lot of folks in Ireland who have been who've read the book and been touched by it and see its relevance both to understanding what in the world happened to the Irish who came to America, as well as what in the world is happening to the Irish who remain in Ireland. So, hope that's not too much of a mouthful.
No, I think that's great. John, if I could just say one last thing about the book that I think is actually also kind of important, is that, and I think set Noel apart a little bit. You know, for Noel was very much shaped by Ted Allen, and, you know, before in the 70s, you know, we'll talk about they had co-written an article together, right? The White Blind Spot is like this kind of major text that was really engaging the left also at that point, and their views on, you know, the role of whiteness and white supremacy in the labor movement. But I think in the Irish, how the Irish became white, I think you really get the sense of their different ideas, right? So I think, you know, Ted Allen, for instance, argued that whiteness was something that was foisted on the American workers by the ruling class, right? And Noel didn't obviously deny that, right? He argued that, yes, that was true, that the ruling class did exploit these racial divisions. But he believed, and this comes really out in the book, that the Irish did make a choice, right? That they made a choice to embrace whiteness to secure a certain advantage in this competitive society, right? And I think when I read the book, you know, I was in college and, you know, I was like thinking about the Albanians in the Bronx, right? And, you know, kind of growing up and seeing how, you know, they too lived alongside Blacks and Puerto Ricans in the Bronx. They also worked in like low service jobs, you know, but once they had secured some level of advantage, man, they did everything possible to keep Black and Puerto Ricans out, right? And I saw this obviously be repeated with the Irish, and I thought that was a very interesting thing to kind of that I think also shapes a lot of Noel's political legacy, right? The understanding that while whiteness is, yes, about a social historical construction, there is like a political choice that certain groups were also making about being included and in, you know, and having some competitive edge over other workers, right? And I think, you know, Noel, STO, right? I mean, this is kind of what they were trying to get at in the years that they worked in factories, right? Like, how do you challenge that in the daily life of how work and institutions are organized, and, you know, the ways in many ways, the ways that white workers benefit, right, and kind of choose whiteness over racial solidarity, and by choosing whiteness, forswear racial solidarity.
Ignatieff posited the Civil War and the emancipation of the slaves was America's true revolutionary moment. So let's pause and talk about this.
Kind of just as a start, I would mention that one of the essays that's included in the collection that we're talking about is the introduction that Noel wrote to the collection of Wendell Phillips' writings, which was titled The Lesson of the Hour. And he, I'm reconstructing this, I'm not remembering it exactly. He tries to acknowledge the immensity of what happened in the Civil War. And first, as a prelude to that, he emphasized, tried to understand, appreciated the significance of abolitionism as a distinctive American, you know, movement, American politics. C.L.R. James, I think, at one point described the abolitionists as the American Bolsheviks. Now, I'm not a big fan of Bolshevism, but in that instance, I'll accept the compliment for them. They were the most determined people, okay, who just basically fought every single day, the radical abolitionists, you know, alongside the slaves, alongside the runaway slaves and the freed slaves, to get rid of that monstrosity known as slavery. And, you know, culminating, of course, in the raid of John Brown at Harper's Ferry, which triggered in many ways, okay, the events that led to the Civil War. The Civil War then became this extraordinary social reality, historical reality. 600,000 people died in the Civil War. And as I forget, one historian has said, is the only thing that could ever have justified that amount of suffering and death and pain was the emancipation of the slaves, which is in fact what did happen. And the kind of the war itself was transformed from what might have been considered a convention generational war, a war that was going nowhere fast, back and forth, just people dying on each side and not making much progress, and then was transformed into a revolutionary war once the goal became explicit that the goal of the war was to abolish slavery, to emancipate the slaves. And that was accomplished specifically by the opening up of enlistment in the North, in the Army of the North, to black folks, to African Americans, both from the North and from the slave states, who fled and joined the army in many, many different capacities. And that basically changed the war into what was a revolutionary war. And for people who are skeptical about this, there are a body of fine writings by Marx and a little bit by Engels that chronicle this, because basically their argument throughout was that's exactly what needed to be to happen in order for the war to be successful. Then the emancipation itself after the war is just an extraordinary amount of property that was seized without compensation. Okay, all of those slaves who were set free, they were kind of, they had been considered the property of people, and they, all of that wealth just vanished, all right, which was kind of quite an extraordinary development. And then finally, Reconstruction, the period that lasted from 1866 to 1877, was a remarkable period of what W.E.B. Du Bois more or less described as proletarian self-activity. He wanted to refer to Reconstruction in South Carolina as the dictatorship of the proletariat in South Carolina. Noel argued consistently against a lot of different opponents that even though that period of time did not follow anything resembling a classical script of workers in industrial settings becoming unionized, organized, forming political parties, you know, kind of, you know, running for parliament, you know, organizing strikes, whatever, that in fact it did represent a kind of a remarkable revolution and needs to be appreciated as a valuable starting point. And one last thing, nothing that the black folks did in black Reconstruction at the end, even though it was defeated, they didn't ever kind of, you know, poison or kind of like soil their memory by betraying the revolution, unlike what was done in other places, mostly in Europe. And so that's one of the reasons, that a set of reasons why we need to have a profound appreciation for the Civil War, for abolition, the Civil War, and black Reconstruction as an ensemble of events.
Thank you, John. I think this is this essay, because it's an introduction to the book, The Lesson of the Hour, is one of my very favorites in the book. And I think it's a really important summary of how Knowles' views were of the abolitionist movement and the importance of it. And I want to talk about one characteristic that he talks about in this introduction as the character of Anthony Burns. And Anthony Burns in 1854, he was a former slave who was living in Boston, and the abolitionist movement in Boston was very strong, and there was multiple attempts to try to, so he was caught by slave catchers to return him back to slavery, and usually abolitionists were able to rescue people or release people and try to rescue them. That on the day of his release, or his return to slavery, to a ship, to the Boston port, they needed 200 soldiers to protect them from the 20,000 from the crowd that was trying to free him. And so he talked about this kind of thing. Is like, he talked about, he quotes this observer about this event. It says, "We went to bed one night, old-fashioned, conservative, compromised union wigs, and waked up stark mad abolitionists." And so, he says, the pro-slavery Richmond Richmond paper says, "One more victory like that, and the South is lost." And so, it's these events that are important to create for activists that change people's minds overnight when these things happen. And I think that's a really important lesson as well from the abolitionists that he talks about in here.
Yeah, I'll just add one thing. I think y'all did such a good job at you know, explaining all of this. I think that this moment is also really important and coming up again today, right? I mean, if you look at, you know, when we were writing the introduction and putting the book together, something that we were thinking a lot about was how a new generation of young people who participated in the George Floyd rebellion, who, you know, embraced abolition, right? That was awesome. That's dope, right? And, you know, Noel was not alive to see that, unfortunately. But I think that would have really excited him, right? And I know that on Facebook, he would have been engaging with those young people, right? And he would have been imploring them to look to the 19th century abolitionists, which are often kind of taken out of that long historical lineage, right? Or they're like alluded to, but not really engaged with, right? A lot of modern day abolitionists look mostly towards like prison abolition or, you know, the 1960s black freedom movements, right? But there is this longer revolutionary history that goes back to the Civil War, that goes back to, you know, Reconstruction, to abolitionism. And something that Noel talked a lot about was that abolitionists were not a huge group in society, right? They were very much always in the minority position, right? Even within abolitionism, there were a lot of reformers, right? But, you know, this small group of abolitionists who refused to make any compromise with slavery and the status quo, right? Was it William Lloyd Garrison who ripped up the Constitution, right? And said no union with the slaveholder, right? The Liberator had massive public appeal, right? Abolitionists, as small as they were, traveled the country, agitated for slavery, right? So I think it's amazing to see what this small group of revolutionaries who did not compromise, who did not want reform, who would not be won over reform, what they were able to realize. And of course, within the Reconstruction, the backlash and all of that. But I think that there's like really important lessons, and I hope, you know, today's abolitionists really look to, you know, to these writings and to Noel's introduction to Wendell Phillips, but also other writings. There's an essay in Heartcrackers too that I also always like, The Creative Provocation, Strategy for Revolution, where he kind of gets at how this small group of abolitionists were able to pull off something so grand, right? And how was the everyday activity of enslaved people, right, who, as Du Bois talked about, fled the plantation en masse, right, and in a general strike in tandem with, you know, the Northern intellectuals and free blacks, right, coming together to form abolition. And I think that's, I don't know, I always think such a dope historical moment. And the last thing I'll say, it's actually a really important historical moment to look at how white participation in abolitionism was not an allyship in all the ways it gets talked about today. And I think, you know, some of that is being challenged and was challenged a lot by the George Floyd rebellion. But, you know, you look at a lot of the white abolitionists, they also sacrificed, took risks. And I think it's a really an interesting way in which black and white abolitionists came together. Of course, you know, still, you know, it's not to say that racism or misogyny, all of those things didn't exist, but together they fought, and they also fought for women's rights, right? Abolitionists were also very much, you know, demanding rights for women. So I just think it's such an amazing period for all of these reasons, and hopefully for a new generation of abolitionists.
We did a previous podcast with the Southern historian, Carrie Lee Merritt. I don't know if you're aware of them, but they wrote a book called Masterless Men, about the collapse. Our discussion was about the collapse of the Confederacy, and we discussed how the state fell in part due to the general strike of enslaved people, but also the mass desertion of Confederate soldiers, whose removal from society caused the collapsing of the economy, and a large part due to the absence of slave patrols. To us, this always begs the question, if that state can collapse because of those mass desertions and those general strikes, what forms of mass desertions today could have a similar effect?
One of the things that Noel and I used to spend a lot of time arguing with our opponents, who were many, in the days of doing Race Traitor, was their accusation that we basically, you know, kind of had nothing but contempt for white people. All we wanted to do was to basically trash them because they were kind of hopelessly tied to white supremacy. And we frequently made exactly the opposite argument, that we said in many ways we thought we had more confidence and hope in the ability of regular, ordinary white folks to rise above the prison in which they were contained by the structures and systems of whiteness, to become part of a humanity that was determined to establish a better world, a free world. But that they would probably not arrive at that point on their own. It was not primarily a matter of working inside their heads to change their mind and to change their opinions. It was instead a matter of creating and fostering the development of new realities that would confront them with new situations. And I think that, to talk specifically about the Civil War, Dave Roediger, another historian who worked in similar territories as Noel, in his relatively recent book called Season Freedom, has some remarkable stories about the ways in which the freeing of the slaves actually happened in the middle of the battlefield. And one of the things he talks about is that when the Northern Union Army soldiers confronted black slaves who had run away and were standing there right in front of them, okay, basically they kind of just acted completely impulsively and said, "You're done, you're free," okay? And that abolition or the emancipation of those slaves was not the result of an order from on high, from the command structure, but rather of simply the instinctive reaction of those soldiers who were faced with humanity in the form of a runaway slave. And I think it's the creation of those kinds of moments, and I think from what I know of the historian you just mentioned, that's the kind of situation that developed inside the Confederacy in the last year or so of the war, that people at every turn were faced with new realities that forced them to reconsider and to change their opinions, and that kind of basically it was new realities leading to new actions that led to new ideas, and not the reverse of that.
Yeah, I was going to say it's hard, right? Because on the one hand, I think when it's definitely a book that's on my list, top of the list. I've been wanting to read it for a long time, and I think a lot about those mass desertions. I've read other things on it. And it's like, yeah, on the one hand, it's like, I'm pretty sure a lot of people that deserted en masse the Confederacy were not doing it in terms of any solidarity or because they wanted, they were really against slavery. In many ways, they were motivated by some self-interest, right? And I think that's an important part, too, to keep in mind, right? I mean, people are going to be motivated by that. But I think it kind of complicates the picture a little bit more. But having said that, I mean, I remember during when Trump was passing these terrible anti-immigration laws, right, where, people were, basically people's ability to continue living in the United States was being called into question. They were going to be criminalized, jailed, imprisoned. People from certain countries couldn't enter the U.S. And that moment when ordinary Americans just showed up at airports, I thought that was very awesome. I imagine with the abortion legislation that's happening, people are going to I've seen so many posts, and I don't know how much of this we will see, and I hope a lot, but where people are opening up their homes, saying that they're going to join collectives to help women get abortion. So I imagine as more and more institutions fail ordinary Americans, and we saw some of this with COVID, we also saw the terrible part of humanity as well. But I do think that, as John was talking about, as these new realities become evident, people will react. I just sometimes worry that, of course, I would want the reaction to be towards human liberation, but we know that there's also these other aspects of it that are not. And I think that's kind of like some of the challenges ahead, too.
John is absolutely right about that last point. I don't think we need, and I realize that some of what I said might have suggested this, to believe in a certain kind of magic. So in other words, that as very complicated realities are changed, it's not as if that there's not still a need for some intentional activity to actually make sense of that change and to kind of carry that message forward. Because people can, faced with the same change reality, think in very, very, and respond rather in very, very different ways. Now, I don't think that, you know, people can be coerced into thinking the right way, but I think it brings us back, oddly enough, to the kind of premise of Hard Crackers, of trying to appreciate and understand the complexities and contradictions of everyday life and people living their lives in those complicated circumstances, so we have a better appreciation for the different ways in which people respond, react, and make sense of what's right in front of them. So I think that remains, there remains work to do.
Throughout times and places, to stay in touch, we've relied on corporations. They buy us and sell us and charge us to use the networks that we created. Baby photos, old friends, and vegan recipes lost to the wind. Nothing in this world is free, you work for them. They go in your memory, soon to be building crypto economies bigger than any country. Damn. Think about that shit. Come on. You don't even own your hot takes. All this ephemeral communication is trash. I'm a poet. Why the fuck I need a Facebook page? I'm not a free speech absolutist. Just not a fan of economists, cops, and white supremacists. The center cannot hold. That's because today's centrists would have been railroad tycoons 100 years ago. Bezos and Musk dance on the scorched earth. That's why Channel Berkman's dagger in every verse. Hope this one hits for the prisons, the houseless, and tomorrow's gallows. While you're at every nickel that's carved, the shallows, zeros and ones, they blind my vision. I'm really with the shit, it's obvious who's just performing. I came into the world through the bullet holes in Guy Debord's heart. My W9's his musician, but that's just how I start. Throat not yet slit, so I sing this. They shoot the cameras, leave no witness. No peace to keep, I'm blacklisted. There was never peace to begin with. Throat not yet slit, so I sing this. They shoot the cameras, leave no witness. No peace to keep, I'm blacklisted. There was never peace to begin with. There's no peace to keep, no place to sleep. Algorithm runs mad, there's no pace to keep. Tech billionaires wanna shut it down. History's taking hold, you can't stop it now. Artificial intelligence seeks to keep the peace. Neither predator or prey, I came to defeat the beast. We are coming to burn the throne, and when we tear it down, you will discover you cannot eat a crown. Or feed your brother when his lips have been sealed, or when he's been put in a cell or simply disappeared. I don't wanna eat the rich, nor do I dream in guillotines. But every time I close my eyes, it's harder and harder to dream. The horizon is smoke, and all the wealth in the world is morally broke. I'm just trying to live, not trying to survive, and raise my kids to have a future where we all can thrive. Throat not yet slit, so I sing this. They shoot the cameras, leave no witness. No peace to keep, I'm blacklisted. There was never peace to begin with. Throat not yet slit, so I sing this. They shoot the cameras, leave no witness. No peace to keep, I'm blacklisted. There was never peace to begin with.
Well, in the intro to the new book, it states, the recent resurgence of right and left populisms in the United States and globally has demonstrated the failure of traditional political parties to respond to the growing immiseration of the working class. Let's dive a little more into this. How is this so?
So I think to start with, we could think about Knowles' view on electoral politics, and he hated electoral politics. And he never voted and never would be. He thought there could be no liberation from elections, no human liberation. And he was, he voted once in some kind of local election in Boston. He said he regretted it immediately because of that person did something terrible very quickly and helped pass some law that was terrible, he said. And now he was responsible for that. But, you know, like usually he wouldn't vote. He wouldn't feel responsible for electing these terrible people to you know, pass these terrible laws. But I think it's, you know, he was always critical of all kinds of forms of social democracy, and he could never bring human liberation because he thought that only a change of the total system could bring human liberation. And people could only be most people didn't want to vote or get bothered to voting because, it doesn't do anything.
Welcome back to Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3 FM. You were just listening to a July 13th episode of the It's Going Down podcast called Cracks in the Racial Order. To hear the rest, head to itsgoingdown.org.
TD Bank proudly invites you to the 16th Annual Festival Haiti of Holi from July 25th to 31st. Discover Haiti like you've never seen it before through music, food and drink fair, book fair, arts and craft, street parade, and so much more. From July 25th to 31st at Quartier des Spectacles, La Fontaine Park, and Cabaret La Tulipe. For tickets and lineup, visit haitienfolie.com, a Fabienne Colas Foundation event.
And before we go, here's some news you can use. The nonprofit The Yellow Door is looking for volunteers for their Generations program. It fights isolation among older populations and creates intergenerational relationships. Each volunteer is paired with a senior with common interests and is expected to share 1 to 2 hours of their week. For more information, visit yellowdoor.org and click on the Programs tab. And the Open Door Shelter is seeking donations of spare smartphones, as well as several clothing items. To see what items are needed, visit the shelter's new Instagram page, which is Open Door Porte Ouverte. You can also follow the page. And the museum's farmer's stand returns to Avenue du Musée next week. On sale, you'll find organic produce, as well as bread and other baked goods. That's next Tuesday, July 26th. From 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. in front of the Musée des Beaux-Arts. For more information, visit the Musée des Beaux-Arts de Montréal Facebook page. And the Museum of Jewish Montreal is showcasing a classic Jewish food in an event called A Tale of Two Bagels. It discusses how New York and Montreal bagels relate to Jewish cultural identity, and it includes food samples. The event is August 4th at 6 p.m., at the museum's location on Saint-Laurent. Tickets are $10. To reserve yours, visit museemontrealjuif.ca. And that concludes this Friday's edition of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective. The collective includes Brian Jefferson, Alice Wu, Joel Salmadal, Killian Davenport-Brown, Tess Pilkington, Pranjal Malik, Moisha Mori, Reema Raji, Michael Edelson, and Sarah Jesmer. For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 2593, or email newsintern@ckut.ca. Also, you can follow us on Instagram at CKUTMTL. Or connect with us on Facebook. Search for CKUT. Stay tuned for Cafe, coming up next on CKUT 90.3 FM.
and I'll limit my activities to only the most essential, all while wearing a mask and staying 2 meters away from others. The virus is still out there, so we have to be careful. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Le Festival international Nuit d'Afrique, le rendez-vous des musiques du monde, vous invite à sa 36e édition du 12 au 24 juillet à Montréal. Ne manquez pas l'une des voix les plus étonnantes du Brésil, Fabiana Cosa, les piliers de la tradition Jinawi, Mokhtar Gania et Jinawa Soul. Le blues éclectique de la fabuleuse Dawn Tyler Watson. Vivez des moments de pure beauté avec la rencontre du Sud-Africain Derek Ripper et le griot de la Corazal Sissoko. Programmation et billetterie sur festivalnuitdafrique.com.
On CKUT 90.3. We're in hour two. Keep it locked and loaded. If you are sweaty, it is time to get a drink. If you need to get up or you're just tuning in, it's going to get live really fast. So if you're with me in the first hour, please stick around for the second hour.